Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. James Baldwin was the prophetic voice of an era that is not over. 50 years ago, he was the frenzied little dark man from Harlem who wrote, in essays and novels, his version of a civil rights movement.
What white people have to do is try to find out in their own hearts why it was necessary to have a nigger in the first place. Because I'm not a nigger. I'm a man. But if you think I'm a nigger, it means you need it. And you invented it. You, the white people, invented him. And you got to find out why. And the future of the country depends on that.
Viewing the ruins of the 1960s, and especially the assassination of key leaders, black and white, James Baldwin spoke a sort of furious, sad song for his country.
I'm terrified at the moral apathy, the death of the heart, which is happening in my country. It doesn't matter any longer, and I'm speaking for myself, for Jimmy Baldwin, and I think I'm speaking for a great many other Negroes too. It doesn't matter any longer what you do to me. You can put me in jail, you can kill me, but by the time I was 17, you'd done everything that you could do to me. The problem now is, how are you going to save yourselves?
We're taking note this hour of the urgency of that speaking voice. It's fresh again in an Oscar-nominated documentary that presents that Jimmy Baldwin talking, talking, talking. Film director Raoul Peck is one of our guests this hour. The lay preacher Cornel West is another. To begin, the author, essayist Teju Cole of the prize novel Open City remarks on the rising chorus of Baldwin's citations and rediscoveries in the last 4 or 5 years.
It's almost as if the lights have been turned on and he's been brought back into the spotlight, really. So, for example, he is the person who gets quoted on Twitter all the time, on social media. He is the go-to quote factory for those who are woke. And there's a way in which he sort of checks all the boxes of being right on. You know, he's queer, he's black. Social justice is his thing, but very emotional also about it. And speaking to the American experiment, to the American experience in a way that does not reject it wholesale either. And with the rise of this social media form, where you really need pithy statements, he became extremely available for that.
Teju Cole has more to say about Baldwin, but first, that movie titled I Am Not Your Negro. Raoul Peck, the filmmaker, is a Haitian artist and activist who has lived and worked also in Central Africa, France, and Brooklyn. His documentary distillation of James Baldwin is a 98% critical favorite on Rotten Tomatoes online. The frame of that film is a book that Baldwin tried to write and put aside in heartbreak about three civil rights martyrs he had known well, Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, and Martin Luther King Jr., shot down in 1963, 65, and 68, all of them dead before their 40th birthdays. The fire in the film is Raoul Peck's selection of Baldwin being Baldwin on video and film.
I knew that the film should be about a direct confrontation between Baldwin and Baldwin's words with the audience. And the purpose was, how do I make it as powerful as they were for me and who use it my whole life? Mm. Because he went really deep into what this society is. And he was the only one who was able to formulate it in a way that a scholar, of course, would understand it, but also the man in the street would understand it. In a way where he could be very critical to the white liberal, but without, you know, pushing them away. He find a way to put every one of us, whether black or white, in front of the reality. He put a mirrors in front of us, and in a way that you can't look away.
What is happening in this country, and what is really happening, is that brother has murdered brother knowing it was his brother. White men have lynched Negroes knowing them to be their sons. White women have had Negroes burned knowing them to be their lovers. It is not a racial problem. It's a problem whether or not you're willing to look at your life and be responsible for it and then begin to change it.
Where do you hear him talking to you? What's he saying? Not writing.
He's a particular author who invented a language. A language that is direct. It's literary, but at the same time, it's like almost street language because he's eloquent. And at the same time, he finds the right words that touches you, that provoke you, that give you structure. And he's telling you right to the camera. And he's saying stuff that today nobody would dare say on national TV.
The Dick Cavett Show!
I don't know what most white people in this country feel, but I can only include what they feel from the state of their institutions. I don't know whether the labor unions and their bosses really hate me. That doesn't matter, but I know I'm not in their unions. I don't know if the real estate lobby is anything against black people, but I know the real estate lobbies keep me in the ghetto. Now, this is the evidence. You want me to make an act of faith, risking myself, my wife, my woman, my sister, my children, on some idealism which you assure me exists in America, which I have never seen.
It's the presence that's so extraordinary. This little, intense, slightly bug-eyed man, obviously the smartest kid in every class he was ever in, adored Henry James, adored church music, adored Duke Ellington, and yet in your face, in a loving manner. This is almost, it is a miracle.
Yes, a very humanistic manner. That's the saying. He never separated all the different part of who he is. At the end of the first line, he hit you with a punch. And before you can get over it, the second line is hitting you in the other direction. So it's a sort of 1-2 that, you know, leaves you on the floor and send you back to some deeper reflection.
Back to the story that James Baldwin didn't finish, about these three men, Malcolm, Martin, Medgar Evers, rubbed out in the 60s, as you say, before they were 40 years old. An utterly unspeakable story. No wonder he couldn't finish it. It reminded me immediately of the Turks. Before they wiped out the Armenians, they killed the poets first.
Yes.
And the articulate people. It's a vision of this country that white America simply cannot imagine, and that black America, I think to this day, cannot dismiss. How is he asking us to deal with it?
Well, that's interesting that what you say about killing the poets, that's exactly what happened. You kill the storytellers, and by killing the storytellers, you kill the narrative, the possible different narrative. And this is what it is about today. Who is writing the story? And it's always have been a privileged minority who is writing the story of this country. You know, that's what Hollywood have been doing since the existence of cinema, is to narrate a world that was one-sided, and that continue until today in the whole entertainment industry. So what Baldwin tells us about that is film is as well ideology. Film is not innocent. Hollywood is giving much more message than just a happy ending story. I see what film did to my own brain. I left Haiti when I was 8. Most of the movie I've seen until then, that was exactly Doris Day, John Wayne, Tarzan. Never was it just entertainment. Mm. It was ideology. It was way of life. It was a way to keep you also in the condition that you are and keep you hoping that some days you will have access to the dream. And it's a totally fake narrative.
Writers and fans keep looking for James Baldwin in his many haunts, on the threshing floor in Harlem in the 1930s, in Paris of the 1950s, in the South, which he covered in the 60s. Teju Cole is the writer who went to a hidden mountain village in Switzerland, Leukerbad, where Baldwin had blazed a trail in 1951. Teju Cole found his way there 2 summers ago on Baldwin's birthday.
He went there to be with his lover and his lover's family, but also to get away from France. You know, he's been in the US, it was uncomfortable for him, he went to France, that got a little bit uncomfortable, and he went to Leukerbad, you know, almost the ends of the earth. And now here he is. And, you know, I think the first line is something like, from all appearances, no black man had ever set foot in this village until I did. So it was a voyage in extremis, and it became a place, I call him his mountain pulpit. It became a place for him to think about racism, brought down to its elemental forms. Mm. And what had happened in the U.S. was that it had been such a part of the way things were in the country that it had gotten so highly complex that it had also become quite hard to read. So in Loikerbad, he found it in very straightforward form, which is kids saying, I want to touch your hair, and, you know, adults suspecting him of being a thief, and everybody staring at him. And so the essay I ended up writing about this journey to Loikerbad became a kind of also an exercise in Baldwinian form. I deeply loved the essay that he wrote about being there. And in my essay, which I called Black Body, I wanted to think about what it meant to inhabit somebody else's space. I was inhabiting his space, and in a sense, in the essay, I was also inhabiting his prose style. Not as a calculation, but to allow the visceral effect of being there as he was there, walking the streets as he walked the streets, to let all of that sort of come through and still have it be analytical. And in the case of Baldwin, do you know where I would actually find a fault? I often want the writing to be more disciplined. Hmm. How dare I say such a thing? You know, but I find it so emotionally outward and really carried along by its own eloquence that I'm often wishing for something a little bit more restrained and therefore, you know, more valuable, more communicative, at least to, you know, the kind of difficult person that I am. And, you know, I could sort of think of myself as a son with many fathers and mothers, and he is one of the people in that role of the father. I want to have a good enough relationship with these artistic parents that I'm not blind to where things are weaker. Because to be able to see that and yet not condemn is also a kind of love.
Teju Cole writes about photography, too, in the New York Times Sunday magazine. Coming up, activist philosopher Cornel West on James Baldwin's resonance today in as blues-like a moment as we can imagine. This is Open Source. Cornel West writes and speaks in the James Baldwin tradition in books like Race Matters and Black Prophetic Fire. You see him on television between Amy Goodman and Sean Hannity. He's back and forth as a teacher, too, at Princeton, and now again at Harvard.
You say, why Baldwin?
Baldwin today.
We live in an age in which there's such a paucity of eloquence. Baldwin exemplifies eloquence at its highest level. Now, when Cicero and Quintilian define eloquence as wisdom speaking, I think we'd have to add as wisdom speaking that's rooted in a courage that refuses to sell out. We live in an age in which everybody's for sale, everything is for sale. Baldwin never sold out. He was true to himself, he was true to his soul. This is, in many ways, the Baldwin moment. And it's primarily because we know here's somebody who's committed to intellectual integrity, committed to a moral honesty. You remember he says at the end of Notes of a Native Son in the introduction, all I ever want to be is an honest man and who, like Hemingway, endures in my work. Now, you see, in an age of mendacity and criminality, which is our own, just telling the truth and having integrity is revolutionary. It's subversive. It's countercultural. So Baldwin comes back bringing this rich tradition of eloquence, truth-telling, witness-bearing, soul-stirring writing. And he's got the black church as backdrop.
Yep.
He's listening to Bessie Smith. He's listening to Mahalia Jackson when he's writing. So you can feel the vibrations and the vibes on the page that are connected to the sonic expressions of geniuses like Bessie Smith and like Ray Charles, of course, was probably his favorite. You know, they were together, you know, at Carnegie Hall.
Yes.
Very historical moment. All that to say is what? In this Trump moment, Baldwin comes back with tremendous power, potency, vitality, and vibrancy, in part because he's willing to speak the truth, not just about the country in the abstract, but the truth about legacies of white supremacy, the truth about indifference, the truth about callousness, the truth about the spiritual blackout, which is the relative eclipse of integrity, honesty, and decency in public life in the country. That's true for Democrats, true for Republicans, true for right wing, true for left wing. It cuts across the board. But Baldwin is one of the few black intellectuals who was the darling of a slice of the liberal elites for a while and then becomes demonized by them later on. And that's why you get the narrative of the early Baldwin and later Baldwin is this right. decline, you see. Baldwin went his own way. He was Emersonian. He was Socratic. In some ways, he was Jesus-like, even though he left the church in order to preach his own gospel.
Can we go back to that moment in the church, because he kept going back to it in The Fire Next Time, but in Go Tell Them on the Mountain, in everything. He's a 14-year-old boy on Lenox Avenue, and he's scared on the outside and he's scared on the inside. He's desperate. He surrenders to Jesus, but it's the beginning of the end of the church story, too. That, to me, is a definition of his anger, his guilt, his fear, but his indomitability, too. With a vengeance. And still, then and ever, he's a good person. He's a lover, not a hater. He's not a racist. People said he complained too much, but he was never defeated.
You know, he tried to commit suicide twice. I mean, those are moments in which despair seemed to have overwhelmed him. He just happened to get out from under and escape. That despair that haunted him every day of his life, at moments it looked as if it would triumph. You are so right. He is certainly a love warrior. He's on the love train. He learns that early on in the gospel with this Palestinian Jew named Jesus, and he encounters the lack of that love in the church, the lack of that love in his stepfather, who's a pastor, the lack of that love in his community. He finds the love in Sister Beale, the white teacher who takes him to Shakespeare, who takes him to these various plays, and he says quite explicitly that he loses his faith owing to the hypocrisy of the church, but also from reading Dostoevsky. And when he gets cussed out for coming back from a Shakespeare play, that Beale, the white woman teacher who loved him to death and would take him around, and his father says, "You will no longer go see those plays, that's of the devil, he just got Shakespeare." He says, "No, the incongruity, the contradictions, the inconsistencies are too overwhelming. The church must go." Now, there's a sense in which, like so many church women and church men, that, you know, he leaves the church for wonderful reasons, because he encounters a love in what that church has to offer at its best. And he remains that love warrior his whole life. And he can't conceive of himself without the metaphors and the stories and the narratives
and the language,
and the songs and the language that come out of that church, especially that black church experience. But he refuses to be parochial. He refuses to be provincial. He refuses to be myopic. And most importantly, he refuses to be xenophobic. Now, unfortunately, you know, most of the church has accommodated itself to myopia, domination, xenophobia, and so on. And therefore, many of us can understand why he left the church. But there's a sense in which the best of the church never left him, just like he never went to college, but a college went through him. He was self-taught. He was a voracious reader. And he was really a kind of a democratic saint, if you define a saint as a sinner who looks at the world through the lens of the heart. He was heartbroken. America broke his heart day in and day out.
What is that love that still speaks in Baldwin?
Baldwin's story is profoundly autobiographical. It really is. Because in Baldwin's own life, there's so much hatred and self-hatred and so much fear. He's being terrorized and traumatized all the time. And yet, he's got to fortify himself. He fortifies himself intellectually, reading voraciously. He fortifies himself spiritually by yearning and trying to unearth sources of love, deep love. He doesn't want to be like Socrates in Hamlet, which is those who suffer from the incapacity to love, even given their intellectual sophistication. That's the last thing he wants. He wants to be more like Amos Jesus, and in the end, like the blues men and women. And in the end, it's the blues men and women who become the very model. You know, it's a wonderful essay, The Uses of the Blues.
Yes.
Oh, that's a classic piece. Classic piece. You really see what is keeping Baldwin afloat, what is in some way allowing all of those composite contradictory tendencies within his own soul to hang together. And it is the blues. It is being on intimate terms with catastrophe and yet responding to that catastrophe with unbelievable style, with a smile, with courage and compassion.
With lyricism, Ralph Ellison said.
And that's what it is. How do you hone a self with integrity in a context of such chronic misery? How do you produce a sound that is full of delicacy and vulnerability, given the master of craft and technique, but unbelievable delicacy and vulnerability in a world that's trying to crush you?
Speak to Baldwin as he speaks about America, speaks to us today. For example, this is more than 50 years ago, he said, "Privately, we cannot stand our lives and dare not examine them." That's us, one-to-one. "Domestically, we take no responsibility for and no pride in what goes on in our country. And internationally, for many millions of people, we are an unmitigated disaster."
Since 2001, how many precious Muslim brothers and sisters have been killed? Innocent ones. Million. That's a lot of human beings. We're in denial. Is there any public discourse about a million Muslims killed since 2001? Absolutely not. We don't even count. We don't even keep track of the bodies. We don't even keep track of the bodies publicly of the American soldiers who have been involved in the invasions and occupations. Now, each life is precious, no matter which country they're from. But we're in denial. That's on the international front. The empire working in denial. Then you come home, and the claim is innocence. What does Baldwin say? Innocence itself is the crime. Innocence itself is the crime. We're innocent. We don't take responsibility for what's going on here. Poverty, wealth inequality. All you have to do is work hard. All you have to do is sacrifice, defer gratification. Now, there are structures and institutions in place that make it very difficult for people to have access to the things requisite for that quest for the American dream that people are still valorizing. Baldwin is hitting it head on. Innocence itself is a crime. You're living in a state of denial. And back to Socrates again. Who has the courage to critically examine themselves and their country in order to become more courageous, more service-oriented citizens and human beings? Baldwin's challenge is more relevant now than it's ever been.
He writes in The Fire Next Time, "The American Negro..." This is 1963. "The American Negro has the great advantage of having never believed that collection of myths to which white Americans cling, that their ancestors were all freedom-loving heroes, that they were born in the greatest country the world has ever seen, that Americans are invincible in battle and wise in peace. The tendency," he says, "in African America has really been to dismiss white people as the slightly mad victims of their own brainwashing."
But you know what? Things have changed since Obama, though, in regard to that claim. You see, all of a sudden now, blackness becomes in part a species of blindness in regard to moral integrity. It's just a matter of success. He won. We've got to defend him. It's a beautiful thing he won, especially given who he's running against. But Ball was about integrity. He's about moral consistency, right? 25,000 bombs dropped year after year under Obama. What did black spokesmen say? Not a mumbling word. Would Baldwin have spoken out? Hell yes. We're in a post-Obama moment, which is a neo-fascist moment linked to Trump and Bannon and others. But we also are dealing with a black community very different than what Baldwin was talking about. We're dealing with a black community that was involved in symbolic celebration, but concrete hibernation. In terms of critique of empire, critique of wealth inequality, critique of class inequality, and so forth, you see. Or one way of putting it is that too many black people, who I love very dearly, each and every one of them, have been involved in breakdancing in the air, but sleepwalking on the ground. Sleepwalking on the ground. Time to wake up. Black Lives Matter, the movement for Black Lives, was a rude awakening among the young folk. How you gonna have a Black Lives Matter movement with a black president? You gotta remind the black president that Black Lives Matter? Yes, you do. Yes, you do. Because these policemen getting shot, and not one of them going to jail, with the black president, black attorney general, and the black Homeland Security cabinet member. Mm-hmm. Something is wrong, right? And Baldwin, in the 60s, he's writing about a black community that hadn't succumbed to the myths of the flag. More black folk were cross bearers than flag wavers. Mm. Now we got more black folk who are flag wavers than cross bearers. Mm. That's not good. Not on the moral spiritual tip. No, it's good in terms of celebrating black success at the highest level. But you can imagine how celebrating black success at the highest level becomes a way of hiding and concealing social misery and suffering in the empire in which we find ourselves.
Speak of the language master here, and you're one in your own right.
Well, no, Baldwin's league of his own, but the beauty of the language, the vitality of the language, just like in the music, is a way of sustaining cells that are in the process of being crushed, demeaned, devalued, dominated, exploited, subjugated, and so forth. And so Baldwin does understand that life is a battlefield. Baldwin's got that fusion of Athens and Jerusalem that is magnificent, but is rooted in gut bucket blues, catastrophe, and the lyricism as weaponry against what's coming at him, you see. Now, why is that important? Well, because these days, you can imagine, a reduced Baldwin would use his language as a way of bringing attention to his gifts rather than using his gifts to be of service to the cause. Mm. Because now we got brands rather than causes. So persons who do have wonderful language, it's primarily to bring attention to themselves to promote their brand for their careers. Whereas for Baldwin, the gifts that he had was to give to others, to try to empower others for a cause. Baldwin was never reducible to a brand. If he was reducible to a brand, he would have remained the darling of the liberal establishment, because that's where his brand was unbelievably popular and flourishing. He made the most money at that time and so forth. When he shifted, it was a shift in cash, money, livelihood. He had to choose between career and calling. He had to choose between profession and vocation. Professional writer, no, my vocation is truth teller. It's very different. He would have to cut more radically against the grain these days, because these days brands are hegemonic.
Yeah,
causes
this is important.
Are pushed to the margin.
How do we explain the decline, shall we say, of eloquence, of truth telling, of the church heritage, the spiritual tradition, of the urgency, the independence of a man like James Baldwin? I mean, look around, all kinds of stars out there, but that voice?
Well, as I say, we live in a moment of spiritual blackout, though, brother. The eclipse of integrity is so pervasive. The commodification, the marketization, the commercialization of everything and everybody, which is expedited intensely every moment, makes it much more difficult for a person to sustain a commitment to something broader than just the next moment of consumption and the next moment of self-promotion. It's a very different kind of moment. It really is. You see it in Baldwin. I mean, at the end of Fire Next Time in 62, in New York or 63 in publication, that he's got hopes. But after the death of Medgar and Malcolm and Martin and so many precious nameless ones in the South and Schirner and Cheney and others, his hopes really begin to wane, and he becomes much more a severe critic with almost an apocalyptic sensibility, as opposed to a critic who's tied to utopian possibilities that have some sense of being actualized. And that's part of his legacy, too. I mean, you got a whole school of Afro-pessimism that's growing every day. It's a whole school of thought. And it could pull from elements of Baldwin, even though we know Baldwin's a prisoner of hope. We know Baldwin it never gave up on possibility, but it got less and less and less space in his corpus.
Cornel West, you live among your students and listen very, very carefully. What are they hearing in James Baldwin today?
They're hearing someone who refused to allow his fire to be dampened by overwhelming bleakness and darkness. And that's a beautiful thing. You know, and I know, the only American citizens who could vote were under 30. My dear brother Bernie Sanders would be in the White House rather than the neo-fascist Trump. That's a sign of hope. The young folk have experienced waves of awakening tied to ecological catastrophe, nuclear catastrophe. They're less racist than their parents. Not to say they're not racist, but you're much less racist, much less xenophobic, much more open to our gay brothers and lesbian sisters and transgender folk, and much more concerned about class issues. Mm. But Trump is the fire this time. It's here. Neo-fascism is unfolding before our very eyes, undermining sources of opposition, be it press, be it courts, be it university, feeling as if it's inevitable that you have to move in a right-wing populist, a xenophobic nationalist, a neo-fascist direction, trashing and demonizing the voices that would try to bring some critique to bear. And thank God we're seeing the best of America, the women's marches and the marches in the airports and so forth. But how they will translate, given the stranglehold of the institutions, because institutional capacity is very important for a movement, not just a matter of hitting the streets. You see, you have to have some institutional capacity that can sustain the resistance and have some impact. And with Bannon and others, you know, these are folk who are reading very closely to Julian Evola's and reading very closely to Gentile's and other theorists of fascism. And they've got to apply it to U.S. circumstances, but it's very real. That's the fire this time.
Lord, it's gonna rain. It's gonna rain. You better get ready and bear this in mind. God sure knows, showed him the rainbow sign. He said it won't be water, but fire next time.
Coming up, the music of James Baldwin. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The news about James Baldwin, besides the Oscar-nominated movie, has to do with the prose writer's bond with music. And some of it is ironic. Who knew that Baldwin, formerly out of the Pentecostal church he grew up in, composed his novels in Paris almost continuously listening to the upbeat gospel hit, Oh Happy Day?
When Jesus
Baldwin was a man, his mother said, who subsisted on music, not calories. Songs and singers set his standard of truth-telling, says our guest Ed Pavlich, in a fascinating fresh study of Baldwin and black music. It is only in music, Ed Pavlich writes in a book called Who Can Afford to Improvise, only in music, as James Baldwin believed early on, that the Negro in America has been able to tell his story.
That notion that it's only in music that a Negro has been able to tell his story, that was from a 1951 essay of his, and he goes on in that passage to say, and it's a story no American is prepared to hear. He says, the popularity of black music is such because many in its audience protect themselves from what's really being said in the music with a sentimentality. So Baldwin in black music is hearing things sung which are really unsayable.
What was the unsayable part that he was hearing?
I was recently listening to an interview that someone sent me, an interview that's never been published and I had never heard before, recorded in 86, you know, very late in his life. And he said, I learned language through black music, and this was an English not spoken by others in America nor spoken by the English themselves. And this was a brand of English that began on the auction block. And so clearly in Baldwin's mind, the basic phonemes, the basic rhythmic and tonal structures of black sound, of black song, had to do with the experience of one's initiation to this grand project of the West as property. as a thing that can be bought and sold. And I think, therefore, in Black Song, Baldwin heard mind and transmitted and carried through history a way of keeping something alive in the self which isn't for sale. Even if your very body and your family and you know, the bodies of your children are for sale. And if that's true, and I think that is true, I think that's a clue to why black music speaks not only to black Americans, but universally around the world, because global capitalism is such that everybody's for sale now, to a certain extent. And that music then is an old and deeply complex and expertly honed discourse of how to save oneself and how to save one's self in the largest sense, self beyond the individual self.
Name a singer, Ed, that we should be imagining. I mean, we think Aretha, we think rappers, we think all incredible range.
Yeah, well, Aretha's one, Ray Charles is another. Baldwin, in an address in 1968 to the World Council of Churches, said that, you know, the problem with the Christian world is it split itself into light and dark. It split itself into good and evil. And he says that in black music, there's an alternative to that kind of split. In the voice, he says, and even the face of Ray Charles when he's singing, it's a sound, it's a presence that just simply can't be divided in those terms. And that gives a singer and a performer like Ray Charles a great sense of power. And Baldwin said, what you hear in Ray Charles is the self connected to its selfless totality. Who would be able to put it that way?
Mm.
You know, one person in our literary history would be able to put it that way, and there it is.
Am I blue? You'd be too.
And Raoul Peck has some fun with that notion. He contrasts Doris Day and Ray Charles. It's almost cruel, but it's so true.
Yes.
Play with it.
Right. So Baldwin's saying in a 1964 essay, The Use of the Blues, he's saying the parable of America can be, you know, brutally maybe, but usefully reduced to this split screen that we have in our culture. On one side of the screen, you have Ray Charles or Mahalia Jackson and that sound, which is, he says, nowhere audible in Canterbury Cathedral, for example, right? And on the other half, you have Doris Day or Gary Cooper, as he says, two of the most, I don't know what the word is, egregious exemplars of American innocence, one could think, or maybe says grotesque.
Yes, it was.
But these are two diametrically opposed notions of what human endeavor and existence is about. And in America, the two rarely encounter each other, you know, which imperils all of us, because we're all implicated in one or more of those paradigms of existence. Doris Day, happy, clean, and safe. Ray Charles, Mahalia Jackson, trying to find a way forward in America and a way to live in America without making oneself this terrible cartoon and this terribly reduced notion of, you know, the pursuit of happiness and what was supposed to be written into existence in the founding of the country.
Ed, what I'm hearing is Baldwin's envy, really, of the musicians. But it's a very universal thing, maybe. Ralph Ellison, I mean, sure. When you think of his power, how many people have read that book, Invisible Man, compared to the people who've heard his great hero, Duke Ellington? I mean, what was the part that Baldwin was missing in his own prose? Prose is a tough medium compared to singing.
Well, true. However, you know, prose is not a platonic quality. It's a political construction that moves through eras of culture and political structures. And so I wouldn't say Baldwin envied the musicians, but he really did come and go from them. Ritualistically, he got great inspiration and insight from them. But I think, too, Baldwin really thought of writers and musicians, himself and musicians, in terms of collaboration and cooperation, you know, that they could make these things tantalizingly plain and almost erotically present in the lives of listeners.
Mm.
But that also puts people in a very dangerous kind of romantic thrall to sensation. And Baldwin always withheld in himself as a writer that kind of distance which wouldn't fully go with both feet in thrall over the ledge with that thing. Something cold and analytical stood back.
You write that his music over the years consisted mainly of the Abyssinian Baptist Choir, Mahalia Jackson, add Billie Holiday, Dinah Washington, but maybe above all, Ray Charles. And he went so far as to have a concert, take part in a concert with Ray Charles in Carnegie Hall in 1973. Take apart that adoration.
He heard Ray Charles. He received what he could from that, and he very much wanted to respond. He wanted to collaborate. He wanted to play in, you know, play in the song. So, but he wasn't a musician, and he couldn't sing, and he couldn't dance. So his writing at large becomes a way of singing back in a way. So, of course, at a certain point it came time in 1973. I don't know exactly how, but it came around the idea of doing a kind of variety show where he would be on stage with Ray. Ray and his orchestra, Ray and the Raylettes, all of it set up on stage in Carnegie Hall, and Jimmy Baldwin on a stool with his, you know, with his little sermon that he wanted to read there to begin, and then he was going to go over, sit in the little alcove, you know, the little space left by a concert grand piano on his stool with a microphone, and interview Ray about the music and what he heard there and what he was thinking while he was singing and what it all meant to him, you know. And, of course, Ray's never going to say that stuff in an interview because he's singing the music.
Now I went down in 52. You know I was scared, but my God and I, y'all know we got through.
Well, what it amounted to was Baldwin, kind of with Ray Charles as an exhibit on stage. Maybe they were both exhibits on stage. And to usher into that hall the music lovers, you know, the jazz community, because it was Newport Jazz Fest, so the jazz lovers and the jazz writers and the critics, who would all come to hear Ray Charles, of course. But there's Baldwin kind of refusing to let this all be universal and romantic and primitive in the ways that often the music and certainly Ray Charles himself was described by the critics. You know, he's some Pine Woods primitive, as one of the critics put it at the time. But Baldwin's saying, no, this is no primitive man. This is a modern man with a political, albeit unstated, agenda, and who speaks on behalf of people who have great existential and political power here, which is imprisoned. And we will release that power and we'll see what happens. And boy, the audience, and especially the jazz writers at the time, were in no place to hear that conversation. They did not want Baldwin's politics and Ray Charles, you know, so-called primitive music in the same space together.
Mm.
And you can see how the reviews of that performance resist exactly that.
We've been through this before in the reactions to Billie Holiday, especially her autobiography. The Whitney Ballyett School of High Modernist Jazz Writers didn't want to hear this. They didn't want to hear the dark night of reality.
That's right. That's right. I mean, what are you going to do? Baldwin was very, very rare among high-profile performers, and he was, you know, a high-profile performer who was willing to really address with increasing frankness and directness embedded political agendas in what it meant to be a success and what people had to do in order to achieve and even more maintain those levels of visibility at the time. As soon as Baldwin made it, when The Fire Next Time, the Down at the Cross essay, which is the 90% of the book, The Fire Next Time, when that essay ran in The New Yorker, it was half of the magazine, right before Thanksgiving 1962, and that made him, you know, the most successful black writer, it made him the most visible black writer, and it made him a mainstream American literary success. And it didn't take him 3 weeks to turn around and start to address that podium of his success for what it was and the limitations it had imposed on him on the way up there. And people didn't, you know, and his liberal fans at the time in The New Yorker and elsewhere were none too happy about this event in their world.
And why not?
Well, because, you know, it's the same as today. It's easy to say, oh, we should all be together. We should all love each other. Isn't love more important than color? As he says in The Fire Next Time, isn't love more important than color? Well, yeah, maybe it is in The New Yorker. But is that true in people's lives?
Mm.
Do your kids really go to school with just any American citizen? Do we buy a house based on, you know, we want to be together with our American brothers? And, oh, this house just happens to be there, so there we are? I mean, we've been prevented by law from doing that. But almost no one does that. You know, and certainly the world is full of a privileged liberal elite who talk one game about American democracy and live in private worlds with private academies, private universities, and all the rest. Mm. No less than the conservatives. And Baldwin was putting his finger directly in their face.
You speak of a political agenda that he was unearthing in Ray Charles's singing, but there's also a sexual component of that. There's a kind of realism. Unfold that and how Baldwin got there.
Well, I mean, those things go together in his mind. You know, sexuality wasn't something narrowly defined as the act of sex, but sexuality was a thing alive in the movements of one's hands and one's tongue and one's ears, one's eyes. It's alive in the way you see things, the texture of food you eat, a passion for life, which is beyond your own private life, that animates the social world around you. And this is rooted in sexuality. And many people know this, but few are really able to follow it through. And I think maybe, you know, because Baldwin's sexuality wasn't sanctioned in America, he was not a heterosexual man. He often resisted being called gay. He certainly resisted the idea that his lovers, who were men, were gay. He said to an interviewer in 1984 from the Village Voice, "The word gay would have meant nothing to my lovers." Hmm. And the interviewer thought he meant they were closeted. He said, "So they moved in the straight world." And Baldwin said, "No, they moved in the world." Just like the politics, this is alive in music in a way that's not strictly about sex. You know, this is about how you relate to your children, how you relate to your neighbor. This is about your profile in the world, which carries that along with it, which refuses to be left at home, as it were. You know, and for a man whose sexuality wasn't heterosexual, that refusal was dangerous. You know, Baldwin himself was swept off the street by police more than once in New York and put in jail for the night simply because he was walking around the street with gay men.
Speak very specifically about blues songs, blues lyrics, the structure of the blues, and what he made of it. And also, he found ways to hear, in the darkest blues, anguish on the way toward joy.
That's right. In the blues, along with Ellison, in a way, right, Baldwin heard a tradition in black life of confronting with great frankness and great openness the vexing things that haunt a person.
Trouble in mind, I'm blue. But I won't be blue always. 'Cause the sun's gonna shine in my back door someday.
Things that vex and haunt in ways that American culture in at certain times and still today in certain ways would indicate that people should keep secret, you know, should shut up about. But the blues is saying, no, the things that vex you, the things that haunt you are the stuff of our public life together. And so the blues finds a voice for that, finds lyrical ways of phrasing those vexing things, and also, of course, finds at times great humor in them, you know, because the ways people flail around in life is tragic, but it's also often, you know, sadly maybe, funny.
He writes, art's purpose is to disturb the peace. That's one political side. He also writes about constants in life, meaning birth, struggle, death, and love.
Yeah.
As opposed to change in life and how art narrates and mediates and describes these tensions.
Yes.
Is there a short description of the large aesthetic that Baldwin was working out in all this stuff between prose and life and his suffering and music?
At one point in his career, basically midway in his career, yes, he says, you know, what freedom boils down to is the ability to identify the constants in life, the things that no human being can avoid, the basic intensities of human experience, birth, death, love, struggle, joy, celebration, and work. These are things that no one can get away from, things that you shouldn't want to get away from, things that you should kind of earn your right to participate in. And then he says, so freedom entails a person's ability to identify the constants and to apprehend the nature of change. Because, of course, the way we experience all those things is constantly changing. We constantly try to improve the way we experience those, of course, do less harm, find a way to inhabit our joyful moments in life and our moments of celebration more fully than we have before, to be present in our lives. In Baldwin's mind, in his life, in his work, freedom is not something that one can be a passive bearer of. Freedom is not the absence of obstacles in a human's path. No privilege can give you what Baldwin, you know, had in mind when he spoke of what it meant to be free in the world. Freedom meant having the wherewithal to be clear about the things that are in your way and to work against those things. It puts you in motion. It puts you at risk.
Ed Pavlich teaches English and creative writing at the University of Georgia in Atlanta. His new book from the Fordham University Press is Who Can Afford to Improvise? James Baldwin and Black Music, the Lyric and the Listeners. Thank you, Ed Pavlich, Cornel West, Raoul Peck, and Teju Cole. There's loads more Baldwin on our website, radioopensource.org. Our show is produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, Becca DiGregorio, and Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our Dinah Washington. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.
Back while the blues uncalled me to pack my things and go. Cause my house fell down and I can't live there no
As you listen to this, Jim, to this record of Bessie Smith, what's your feeling?
It's very hard to describe that feeling. The first time I ever heard this record was in Europe, and in very different circumstances than I'd ever listened to Bessie in New York. And what struck me was the fact that she was singing, as you say, about a disaster, which had almost killed her. And she'd accepted it, and was going beyond it. It's a fantastic kind of understatement in it. It's the way I want to write, you know. When she says, "My house fell down, and I can't live there no more," it's a great sentence. It's a great achievement.